Listen now with new ears to this familiar story from Luke's gospel. But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they came to the tomb, taking the spices that they had prepared. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they went in, they did not find the body. While they were perplexed about this, suddenly two men in dazzling clothes stood beside them. The women were terrified and bowed their faces to the ground, but the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here, but is risen. Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be handed over to sinners and be crucified and on the third day rise again." Then they remembered his words, and returning from the tomb, they told all this to the 11 and to all the rest. Now it was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary, the mother of James, and the other women with them who told this to the apostles. But these words seemed to them an idle tale, and they did not believe them. But Peter got up and ran to the tomb, stooping and looking in. He saw the linen cloths by themselves. Then he went home, amazed at what had happened. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Please pray with me. O Lord, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Why do you look for the living among the dead? It's a good question, and not just for the women at the tomb on Easter morning. How often do we look for the living among the dead? Looking for life in places where there is none, tending to the corpses of former visions of ourselves, of life before a loss, revisiting fresh endings as if we might find clues to a future there in the rubble of the past. It's a good question for the church in our time that so often seems stuck in the nostalgia of the past, speaking longingly of times when the children were plentiful, the resources more than adequate. We keep looking for the living among the dead. And it's a good question for a culture obsessed with wanting to make all kinds of things great again. I know that this has become a partisan slogan, but I've heard this sentiment expressed in different ways across our political spectrums. I have heard African-American elders wonder if desegregation should now be celebrated as a win or marked as the beginning of the destruction of African-American institutions and the community they supported. I've heard newspaper reporters wax nostalgic on the days when the readership was as plentiful as the reporters hired to cover all the news. I've heard more than one lifelong Baltimorean recall those bygone days when Bethlehem Steel kept the unemployment rate low and the city full and functional. We all long for the past in different ways. We have all looked for the living among the dead. The women don't answer the angel's question, maybe because the answer is obvious. when we cannot see a discernible future ahead of us, one that is obtainable or rational or reasonable, the past seems like the only real option available to us. We go back there looking for evidence that things don't have to be as bad as they are in the present. Or we go back there looking for positive memories to help us cope with present pain. Or we go back there because in the deepest kinds of endings, sometimes we don't know where else to go. The women don't give the angels an answer, maybe because it is the wrong question as far as they are concerned. They do not come to the tomb looking for the living among the dead. They come looking for the dead among the dead. When the body of Jesus was placed in the tomb, the text right before this one, the one that closed out the Friday night crucifixion story, says, "The women saw the tomb and how his body was laid. And then they returned and prepared spices and ointments." They were coming to anoint his dead body. They had to wait to get to the tomb because yesterday was the Sabbath, and they rested like you were supposed to do on the Sabbath. But when they headed to the tomb that early Sunday morning, they knew that what they would find was Jesus' body in the tomb where they had already seen it. They were not coming looking for the living among the dead. They were coming to tend to the dead. I don't know why the angels ask this question that seems to miss what is actually happening with these women at the tomb. Maybe these particular angels were inexperienced or trying something new. I mean, none of the other angels that appear at the beginning of Luke's gospel, Gabriel telling a surprised Zechariah that he will become the father of John the Baptist, Gabriel announcing to Mary that she is pregnant by the Holy Spirit, the angels who appear to the shepherds keeping watch over their flocks by night, none of them asks any questions of the people they surprise with their visits. They just announce realities. "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you will name him John. Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God, and now you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you will name him Jesus. Do not be afraid, shepherds, for see, I am bringing you news of great joy to all the people. And this will be a sign for you. You will find a child wrapped in bands of cloth and lying in a manger." The only questions asked in all of these angel stories come from the people visited by the angels, not the angels themselves. Maybe these two angels at the tomb missed the memo. Just show up and announce. Don't ask questions. And for goodness sakes, reassure the people that you are visiting that they need not fear. That's what every other angel announces in Luke's gospel. Do not fear. It is also what happens in Matthew and Mark's versions of the resurrection story. Do not fear. The first words out of nearly every angel's mouth except these two. It is not like the women in Luke's gospel are any less terrified. They were so terrified, the story today tells us, that they couldn't even make eye contact. They had to look down at the ground. But I wonder if Luke's angels start with this question, "Why do you look for the living among the dead?" Because they have some idea of the burden that these women are about to carry with them. The burden that it is to speak resurrection nonsense in a world that has already decided that the past is better than the present and maybe even the future. The burden that it is to carry hope in a world that is drenched in fear. The burden that it is to allow yourself to believe that tomorrow can be better than yesterday, that greatness is not something that has to be exhumed from the past and dragged forward from the dead. The angels know that the terror that these women feel at the tomb is the beginning of their troubles. It is not the end of them. You try announcing resurrection hope in your own life and see what happens. Try telling your friends and neighbors that you believe that Baltimore's best days are ahead and not behind, and see what kind of a response you get. Try announcing that the divisions in our land are not as permanent as we may think, and you see what kind of reaction you receive. Try announcing that the fear that so many now carry in their hearts, fear of immigrants, or fear of black bodies, or fear of the police, or fear of economic collapse, or fear for our children's future, can be overcome by the power of love. And let me know what happens. If you allow yourself to believe in empty tombs and the possibility that God can and does bring life where the world knows there is only death, if you allow yourself to believe and risk sharing that conviction with others, things will get more difficult, not easier. And those angels, they seem to know this. And so they ask a question to challenge instead of to comfort, to spark their imagination and reframe their own ideas about what is possible. A question that is more of a suggestion than an inquiry. Seek out the living instead of looking for the dead. Seek out what can give us life instead of the things that are bringing us death. Seek out where God is headed, not where we've already been. It is a question to agitate these women to persist in that quest, even when their life-affirming good news is rejected. The angels know that gospel news is always met with resistance. Remember how we told you that the Son of Man must be handed over to sinners and be crucified, and on the third day rise again. Remember. Not a memory of days gone by, but a memory of Jesus' promises, of his words, and of his warnings. Jesus warned you that resurrection hope doesn't come easy. It comes in the midst of struggle, not instead of it. It comes in the midst of doubt, not the opposite of it. It comes in the middle of your grieving, your wounding, your suffering, not as a substitute for any of it. Remember Jesus' words, and you will be remembering your future. Remember Jesus' words, and you will be able to persist in your proclamation, even when this life-affirming good news is rejected. And rejection is exactly what these first proclaimers receive. They leave the tomb and immediately experience the burden of bearing resurrection news, the burden of announcing resurrection in a world that is already settled into the idea that the things that Jesus was peddling, love of neighbor, forgiveness of enemies, peace among the nations, abundance instead of scarcity, hospitality to the stranger, enough for everyone, that all of that is a bunch of hogwash. That's what the disciples call it when the first women tell them what they saw. An idle tale. Leros in the Greek. The most accurate translation I can give in church without upsetting anyone is a bunch of bull. Leros. These words seemed to them a bunch of bull, and they did not believe them. Don't you see? It's an aggressive rejection of the women's testimony, more aggressive than is necessary just to reject the message. It is a power play, which seems so incredibly contemporary at a time where people actually seem comforted by the familiar news that the world stinks, that everything can only get worse, that we can't solve problems together, that we can't learn to love each other, that corruption and incompetence and unethical behavior has spoiled everything permanently. We have found comfort, haven't we? Comfort in the dismissive rejection of the idea that God can actually do a new thing. Now, I am sure that as women living in the first century, they were used to this kind of power play, this kind of dismissive rejection. It's been the experience of many women for a very long time. From women, the historian Josephus wrote at about the same time that Luke's gospel was being written, "Let not evidence be accepted because of the levity and temerity of their sex." Of course, their testimony was rejected. And if we are honest, most of us, regardless of our gender or theirs, have a hard time believing their testimony too. Not for the misogynist reasons expressed by Josephus, but because of the news itself. Angels at an empty tomb are hard to believe, regardless of the source of this testimony. But maybe that is exactly why women had to be the first witnesses at the tomb, the first preachers of resurrection, the first bearers of this testimony. Because if you are going to announce that God is able to bring life where we see only death, you better be prepared to encounter severe resistance. If you are going to proclaim that God's love is stronger than our fear in an empire built on fear, then you've got to expect to be dismissed. If you are going to vocalize that more is possible in our world than what we have come to accept as our current situation, then you are going to need the experience of persevering when you are dismissed, rejected, even ridiculed, sometimes in ways that are way more aggressive than is necessary. Announcing resurrection hope isn't for the faint-hearted. It is only for those intent on rejecting the status quo culture that infects all kinds of people, even Jesus' so-called closest followers. And yet, once resurrection is announced and entertained as a real possibility, the whole world looks different. The possibility for life in the midst of death, the possibility for beginnings where there seems to be only endings, the possibility for hope where most of the world sees only despair, the possibility for love where there is so much fear. The possibility for a future that is different from the past, it is all waiting there, waiting for just a few messengers, just a few proclaimers, a few first converts to the possibility that God is already at work in the midst of our harshest suffering, our worst endings, our deepest wounds. God is already at work in the midst of our city's implosions, our nation's betrayals of its guiding values, our planet's human-induced destruction. God is already among the living, making that way in the wilderness, giving water in dry places and rivers in the desert. God is doing a new thing among the living. Among the living. Among the living.